Hey there, podcast listeners. This is Tyler with the Horrible Podcast, and it is now just past the July 4th holiday, and I thought, what a great time to discuss Jaws, which is one of my favorite, not just movies, but now that I've read the book, not a bad book either. So it's going to take a little time to talk about Jaws. I know that on the podcast, we don't really discuss our favorite movies, well, except in context of the movie we're supposed to be watching and actually don't really talk about. So in lieu of the fact that we won't do an actual review of Jaws, I'm going to take a little time to talk about my feelings about just all of it in general, maybe bring up some notes about stuff and talk about the publication of the book and Peter Benchley and sharks and my memories of sharks, just to give you something to listen to on your commute or whatever if you happen upon this on the website. I've always said that Jaws is my favorite movie. I always list it as the top whenever I'm asked, "Oh, what's your favorite flick?" That's always at the top of my list. Also, just so you know, there might be the sound of a cat meowing around my feet. I'm podcasting at home tonight, and there's a little black cat that's all next to my feet. So if you hear some meowing, that's where it's coming from. Meow. But anyway, yeah, Jaws is always the movie I put at the top of my list. Whenever I talk about favorite movies, Jaws, and then Seven, and then Fight Club, and then The Big Lebowski, and the rest of it. So Jaws is up there. And it's weird that I say Jaws, because on the list of my top five favorite movies, Jaws is probably not the movie I've watched the most. Of Seven and Fight Club and Big Lebowski, I've probably watched those three movies more than I've watched Jaws. But favorite here sort of just delineates the fact that there's something about that movie that represents something that I aspire to as both a writer, and like when I see a movie that I feel very, very strongly about, that movie sort of embodies that aesthetic. There's something about the three guys on an adventure sort of almost allegory that the movie takes that just makes it unparalleled in a lot of ways. I'm not saying Jaws is the best movie ever made, but it's certainly one of the best movies ever made. But I also still think it is, I mean, there's something about the characters and characterization, the way that the movie comes together, the lack of seeing the shark for a great deal of the movie, that sort of winds together all of these things that just remind me of childhood and the beach and being afraid of sharks, just also the movie-going experience. There's something about it, and I've never seen it in the theater either, which I would love to do if a second-run theater did something like that. I'd definitely love to see Jaws in the theater. But there's just something about the way the story unfolds, the way that the characters sort of manifest their best and worst aspects, and then put that against this thing. You know, it's very Hemingway-esque. I mean, this is man versus the environment and man versus a beast. And you can probably hear the cat meowing now. So I'm going to have to kick it out. But anyway, yeah, Jaws, the idea that the shark is terrorizing Amity Island and how people react to it, like, it's not similar to other slasher movies or other horror movies of the time period. This is not, the shark is just, it represents an idea about fear too, because it is a localized fear, and it, in some way, it sort of embodies the idea of how irrational fear itself is. Like, if you think about how mass hysteria gets started, especially in a post 9/11 world. I still managed to get that phrase into this podcast, even though this movie takes place in the 1970s. It manages to hit all of the sort of right ideas about mass hysteria and how that sort of thing gets started. I mean, fear is irrational in some ways. I mean, you can die from a shark attack, and if you were in Amity Island at this time frame, you are more likely to die by shark, but there are very few shark attacks in the world every year. So it's weird to think of a shark attack as the way to go. Well, you know, as your way to go. Not like, hey, that's the way to go. Sharks, eh. So fear comes from something that is irrational. Some place like fear of dying, you know, like plane crashes, like having a plane crash movie. That's a very alluring idea, but actually dying in a plane crash is a really rare idea. So it's cool that this movie Jaws is able to sort of take all of our fears and put them into a single thing, because it's not really about the shark. It's about the way that people react to the shark. If you look at the way the town of Amity, which is weird because there's also the movie Amityville. Weird. Okay, anyway. The way that Amity responds to the death of a few swimmers, boaters, and the like by shark attack just shows how we are programmed as people. I mean, all the people in that movie react totally irrationally on both sides of the spectrum. I mean, Brody, granted, wants to save people's lives, Sheriff Brody, the Roy Scheider character, by closing off the beaches, which is a totally understandable thing to do. But most of the island, like, they are driven by more than just this sort of, like, very base idea of heroism and the right thing to do, because they have, I mean, the complicating factor here is the way that the island makes its money. People have to sell things to tourists in order to survive. And if they don't survive, then they may have to move or go on food stamps. And those are also pretty terrifying ideas, especially at a time when this novel was published. It was published right after Vietnam. I mean, 74, so right in the middle of all of this. I mean, right in the middle of Watergate. And the movie came out in June of 1975, so 39 years ago, you know, last month. So it predates the late 70s sort of Carter stagnation of the economy, but that was still sort of going on in the early 1970s from what I understand. So fear of loss of, you know, material goods. I mean, that's the thing that keeps most people up at night. The idea that what if I lost my house? What if I lost my job? What if I lost insurance and then got hurt? Those are the sorts of things that haunt me. You know, those are the sort of things that make me stare at the ceiling at night and stay up way past my bedtime. And those are real fears. But a lot of times they're codified in these other ideas, like with the people of Amity and the shark. And, you know, this is sort of a tangent, but it's interesting how the movie portrays fear and how we rationalize fear. Because it's only when financial interests come into play that people become really afraid. And really, the scene where Quint sort of scratches his nails down the blackboard, you know, y'all know me, know what I do for a living. That scene is about hysteria. And most of the movie at that point is about hysteria. Whether it's people who are hysterically afraid of sharks or hysterically afraid of the future and unknown future. And the shark really sort of symbolizes that idea in a really interesting way. Because it's not like an enemy you can see or predict. I mean, that's one of the things that I enjoy about the novel, was that it discusses how unpredictable a shark is. And it's not something that, I mean, a shark can attack once and never attack again. And that's usually the case. A shark will attack once and then go away. Whereas Jaws here attacks several times, like a rabid shark. Also, it's taken me 10 minutes to say that I also read the book last month. I mean, maybe I mentioned that earlier, but this is a podcast, a single podcast episode about Jaws the book. And I guess my feelings about Jaws the movie, but also because it's July the 4th and the movie and book take place near July the 4th. And I love the movie and the book. So this is just a love letter to all of that. But it does some really interesting things. I guess I'll talk about the book a little bit in relation to the movie. It's one of the rare cases, although there are a lot. I mean, we could sit down and talk about the number of movies that are better than the books. I mean, Fight Club for me is like that. That's another movie that is better than the book. It took the ideas of the book and then honed them to a bludgeoning tool. That's one of the things I love about Fight Club, the movie. But Jaws is a fine book. But what the movie seems to do, after having read it, what the movie seems to do is it whittled down everything that was unnecessary about the book and tore it away. Just kind of like, you know, made it light enough so that it could be faster, kind of like a speedboat, to keep a sort of maritime analogy, so that it could just be as quick and as fast as possible. Like, the big thing that I kind of want to talk about in regards to what the book seemed to do that was weird that the movie changed was there is a relationship in the book. Martin Brody's wife, Ellen, has an affair with a much younger Matt Hooper, which is weird. And if you've only ever seen the movie, I'm going to let that sink in for a second. Sheriff Brody's wife, Roy Scheider's wife, has an affair with a much younger man who is also one of the main characters and heroes of the novel. Oh, I got to log back into my computer so I can hear some tapping. Okay. Some tapping. You're going to hear some tapping on my computer keys. Doll's keys. Anyway, so that's one of the things that the movie gets right. Because maybe it's only because I've seen the movie so many times that a relationship, the affair seems like a really weird idea in lieu of the movie. Like, in retrospect, but it kind of fits, and but it's weird. Like, it seems placed in the middle, and it doesn't get resolved. Is one thing. Like, one of the things that happens in the book is that she has this affair. It's a one-time thing. It's sort of like she needs to be reset. That's sort of the language that the book puts in there. Is that she's, you know, she has sort of forgotten who she is because she was. The dynamic between Martin Brody and Ellen is that she was a sort of rich girl who married the schlub who's always lived on the island, which is also different from the movie because Brody moves from New York. That's the implication. He moves from New York to Amity, but is afraid of the water, which I think is a cool idea. Much better than the book, I think. But also, the book has her sort of unhappy with Brody, and there's a lot of tension between them. Because she is unhappy and he doesn't. He in the book, Martin Brody is more of a caveman, like angry and doesn't know how to express himself, and the silent, strong silent type. And he's prone to outbursts and just doesn't really know how to speak and communicate and with his wife. And so she has this affair, not necessarily because of him, but because of her. Like it is very clearly. A her thing. She needs to do this. And it isn't a weakness in her, nor is it really portrayed as a weakness, but just as a necessity. Like she has this, it's kind of like, to quote Fight Club, you know, the Marla Singer is the wound at the roof of your mouth that would heal if you'd only stop tonguing it. And I think the idea that if she sleeps with Matt Hooper, who in the novel is more of also, you know, the rich boy who comes to town, like that idea is really poignant. And so, but the movie cuts it out and makes it all, because the movie's really about those three characters, the relationship between Martin Brody, Quint, Hooper, a shark. That's what it's really about. It's about those three dudes. It's a very man-ish story. Like, it's all about the men doing men stuff, but also with these weird, like, very obvious flaws. And speaking in allegorical terms or metaphorical terms, it's like Moby Dick. I mean, it's really no different. But it is about sort of the love that men have when they're out at sea or like chasing down a dream. Like you could make this story about King Arthur. I mean, really it's kind of like Raiders of the Lost Ark in that way. So the King Arthur tale, or, you know, with Sir Lancelot and Galahad. I mean, I guess the book is more like that with the affair, but this also has that. And each character has very obvious flaws. Matt Hooper is sort of naive and brash because he's young and a know-it-all, so he thinks that he can survive. And in the book, he doesn't, which I think the book gets it right there. I mean, it's weird for Hooper to just to be able to hide from the shark at the end and then survive and paddle back to shore. And obviously in the movie, Brody is a man who is tough on land. He doesn't have sea legs. So placing him where he is most vulnerable and most afraid is a really nice touch. And then there's Quint, and Quint seems like a really complicated character, but it's almost like he has a really obvious flaw, and his obvious flaw is that he is the Ahab of the story, because he hates this shark, and it seems all sharks, because he was on the USS Indianapolis when it was sunk, and, you know, 800 men were eaten by sharks. I'm not going to play that, but if you remember, that's one of the tattoos, is the USS Indianapolis and being outside in the ocean, having his best friends and, you know, comrades taken down by sharks. That is what has driven him, and that is the same thing that sort of drives Ahab. And it's ultimately what gets him killed. I guess the difference is that their self-preservation is what either kills them or saves them, because Quint's self-preservation is his sort of like manic ego, and that he's willing to die in order to punish the shark for what the shark has ostensibly done to him or the people he has known. So there's that, like, he is that character. That is his archetype. And we have seen, I mean, he's almost like, tilting at windmills, you know, but, Quint's is very obvious, and Martin Brody's, I don't know. But Hooper's is like, his self-preservation saves him, because he has this really brash idea, but then is smart enough to abandon it rather than to take it to its logical conclusion. And Brody's is weirder, because his is just, his self-preservation is about keeping his job and doing the right thing. And in that way, like, he kind of deserves to survive. He has his comeuppance. He is the character throughout the story, in both the book and the movie, who has the most heaped upon him. He is the pawn of the local selectmen, because in the book, it goes into much more detail how the mayor, Larry Vaughn, convinces him not to close the beaches. And that's one of the most contentious aspects of the books, is that he is played by Larry Vaughn, the selectman, and also the, I've forgotten his name, but there's a news editor in the book who, you know, writes, he is the local newsman. And so he sort of convinces Martin Brody that it's okay to close the beaches. He later recants, and that makes him a much more sympathetic character, but he is also conspiring in this to keep the beaches open so that obviously he can survive, like everyone else can survive. And so Brody, as opposed to the others, is willing to put himself out there, is willing to be wrong. And obviously he's the face of the town. So whenever the kid is killed in both the book and the movie, he is left out. And you know, in the book, a story in the newspaper gets it right, gets it out there, and the mother finds out and is absolutely furious, kind of the way that it happens in the movie, but differently. And so Martin Brody is different from all the other characters, because he has to sort of wear his failures. They're not secret. They cannot fester. So he sort of wears them in public, and then he is sort of absolved because his mission is just and true. Like, he is not out on a mission to sort of, he is halfway between Hooper and Quint, who are at opposite ends of a weird shark spectrum. Shark Spectrum would also be the name of a band, if I had to guess. That would be an awesome Shark Spectrum. Great band name. And because Hooper is the guy who wants to lift up sharks and say that they're more or less harmless. This is just the way that they are. Whereas Quint says, this is the way they are, but I want to kill them for it. Like, this shark deserves to die. And eventually Hooper gets on board with the idea of killing the shark, especially after, you know, Jaws pounds the boat for a couple of days. And, yeah, I mean, the male bonding in the movie is like, what's great about the story for me is that these characters couldn't be more different, and yet they come to sort of find a common cause and a common path and sort of a commonality between them, and singing the songs and comparing scars, being out there, just being forced in this sort of crucible situation to respond and respect one another for their differences. Like, that, there's something oddly elating about that for me, to see Quint sort of accept Hooper, even though he's this newfangled college boy, and to accept Brody, even though he sees him kind of as a wimp because he's afraid of the water. Although he never quite gets to the point of full acceptance, and Brody, it sort of comes together for Brody at the end after Quint is dead. And after Hooper can't see him, like, he has to be alone to get to be brave enough to face down Jaws, the shark. It's really, I mean, it's really interesting. But anyway, I mean, the book itself is not a bad read. There's some weird stuff in it, though. So Peter Benchley wrote it in the early 70s. He was kind of commissioned to do it. I think he was given $1,000 at the beginning. And then at the end, I think he started in 71 and by 74 was published, and he got 7,500 when it was published, when it was first published. So that was 8,500 bucks for 3 years work, which is weird if that's correct. I think he also got paid sort of intermittently in the middle of that, but 8,500 bucks basically. But then, I mean, even before the book, I think before the book was published, yeah, before the book was published, some producers read it and immediately bought it in a bid for $150,000. And eventually the book went on to sell something like 6 million copies over the course of, maybe over the course of a year, a couple years. Still, that is a ton of books. And it has some weird parts, some things that do not hold up today. Because Peter Benchley focused his eye on some very specific things, the domesticity of the Brodies and the difference between people. There are socioeconomic concerns here that are fairly progressive, like very progressive in a lot of ways, because he spends a lot of time talking about small town life and how people who live in these communities can't survive. That is one of his concerns, and it's at the heart of the novel. So in that respect, he does a fine job. But there's also weird race stuff. Like, there is a lot of talk about black people doing not great stuff on the part of Benchley. And it seems to, like, Peter Benchley seems to be a writer who is concerned with representing, like, he wanted originally to write Jaws as a nonfiction story. And so he seems to care a lot about, like, using fiction based on the newspaper articles he's read. And I guess, like, there in Amity, there is a rapist who was black, and then there's other talk about black people. There's a weird sort of, like, race relation issue in this book. And I can't quite put my finger on it, but it does seem like it was, when I, in reading it, it felt icky. Weird, like, weird in a way. So, I mean, to be able to enjoy it, you have to kind of sidestep that aspect of it, but it is very much a book of its time. So it's not something that, you know, I don't know. I feel weird talking about that, but I did notice it. And I feel like it's something that if you read today in 2014, this book is 40 years old at this point. So there are some weird aspects about race in there, but it's also kind of, in part, clumsily written. Like, Peter Benchley sort of over-narrates the book from the characters' minds, and some very obvious things are put in the book that don't necessarily need to be there. So, as an artifact, you know, the movie holds up much better. And I actually, with my girlfriend, watched Jaws on July the 3rd, and it actually holds up. To be 40 years old, holds up really well. It'll be 40 years old next year, and it holds up really super well. So, I mean, given the choice, watch the movie. I mean, I mean, it's obvious, right? But also, if you haven't read the book and really love the movie, read the book. It's not bad. Hey, I say like that, like, hey, it's not bad. What's that? But that's really all I have to say about it. I can't think of anything right now. I guess I could talk about, like, what it was based on. But I don't want to get into the shark attacks from 1916. Maybe I'll do that in a future episode. Because I really want to do this week an episode about the Black Dahlia murders. I'm really, really into that stuff right now. And I'm finishing up Mr. Mercedes. So if you're listening to this, I'll either convince Drew, who has read the book, to do a podcast episode with me, or I'll do one by myself, because this kind of thing's fun. It's kind of weird to talk by yourself into a microphone, but, you know, I dig it. I dig it, man. So, I mean, those are really my thoughts on Jaws. So, I got, loud stuff. So, I mean, that's all. This is Tyler with the Horrible Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. What can I call this? Alliterated with an I? Alliterated. I think I'm going to call it that. Alliterated Volume 1. Jaws. Because I did the TNYA series, but yeah. Anyway, Alliterated Volume 1. Jaws. Check it out. Bye.